But first of all, it might be a cliche, but some people probably don't know. How did you get started in the music business?
Well, when we talk about the music business, you mean how do they get started in show business or actually in jazz? Because there are two different beginnings for my career. The first career was in vaudeville with my parents, and the second aspect of my career started in 1937 in jazz at the Hickory House in New York City. And that came about through listening to jazz in the early days on radio, and then by having the good fortune one weekend to sit in at the Hickory House with Joe Marsala, and was hired by Joe after hearing me play the one afternoon on a Sunday afternoon when they used to have jam sessions at the Hickory House. That's how my career in jazz started, actually.
Well, you started way back before that. Weren't you about 2 years old or something, you know, very, very young when you started with your parents?
Well, I was 2 years old, just exactly 2 years old, when I first started pounding on tables and chairs and whatever it is that kids pound on when they're 2 years old. And, of course, the next 8 or 9 years, I went through all kinds of experiences in vaudeville with my parents. But that was more of a show thing. It wasn't really musical, and it wasn't, of course, by any stretch of the imagination, jazz. But that was a beginning for me that I think came in so handy later on in my life, the fact that I had a show business career in front made it possible for me to assume certain attitudes and positions that were very beneficial to me later on in my life.
What was the jazz scene like when you entered it back in those days in 1937?
Well, jazz, of course, had a much more prominent part in society than it has today. There were so many great jazz artists, and there was so much, the interest in jazz was so much greater in depth. People knew more about what was going on. I remember on 52nd Street alone, when I was at the Hickory House, there were at least a half a dozen clubs on that very same street, all playing jazz at that particular time. Across the street from the Hickory House was Kelly Stables, and they had Roy Eldridge and, what's his name on drums? I can't think of his name. Kenny Clark. And up the street was the famous Door, and they had Count Basie in there. And up the other street, up the other corner, they had, who did they have? George Shearing first came on the scene when he came over here from England. So that there was, altogether, there was more jazz, I guess, on 52nd Street than any other city in America at that time. And every club presented a different type of jazz, but it was all jazz, and it was all excellent.
How did you get to Bunny Berrigan's band?
Well, when I left Joe Marsala after being there for a year, a little over a year, about a year and 4 months, Bunny Berrigan's band was playing out in Brooklyn, where I come from. He was playing out at Brighton Beach, and Georgie Auld was in that band, great saxophone player. And Georgie was from Brooklyn, and there was an opening in Bunny's band for a drummer. And he suggested that I come out and audition for the band out in Brighton Beach. And I did. And of course, being a Brooklyn boy and having all the guys out there on the beach in their bathing suits and playing an afternoon session on the beach, which is something that isn't done very much anymore, I played pretty well with the band. I was offered the job and took it. I stayed with Bunny about 6 months. And while with Bunny, I was offered a job with Artie Shaw at More Money. And Artie Shaw's band at that particular time was on the move up, and Bunny's band was on the decline. He'd been drinking a great deal. And I thought it would be more beneficial to start looking for better things, which I did. I went with Shaw in 1938, the latter part of 1938. And that was a great musical experience for me.
Getting back to Bunny, you know, he takes on aspects of a romantic character in jazz history, and a lot of people have compared him with Bix Beiderbecke in terms of his temperament and really his legend. What kind of a guy was he?
I guess you could categorize Bunny as being a fun lover. I don't know if it's romantic or not, and I don't know if he can be compared to Bix, because I didn't know Bix. And I know less about his career, but I do know that Bunny was a kind of a non-caring individual who whose concern, I think, was more for his own personal pleasure, drinking and carrying on, than it was for his music, which is one of the reasons, I think, why I wasn't too happy in the band, because he never did take his music seriously enough for me. He had something great going, and he could have probably been one of the great band leaders and had one of the great bands of all time if he had been a little more serious about where the band was going. But that band was what we would term today as a road band. Very few locations for the band. The band was constantly doing one-nighters. I think out of the 6 months I was with the band, we did 4.5 months of one-night stands. So that it was, even in those days, well, particularly those days, because in 1937, 38, buses weren't equipped like they are today with air conditioning and heating and all the other things that make you comfortable. So that it's hard to relate to that band 30 years later, because what was good, what was fun, what was experience in those days, today as I look back, I don't think I could do it again. It was just too difficult, too hard.
What kind of a band was the Berrigan Band? Was it a good band, Buddy?
It was an excellent band. It was an excellent band. He had Joe Bushkin playing piano, Georgie Auld, Joe Dixon on clarinet. He had some very fine, excellent players in the band. But they took, the musicians in the band took on the aspect of the leader, which I think happens in most bands. If the attitude of the leader is one of laxity and, well, the kind of freedom of no discipline in the band, the musicians take advantage of that. And consequently, there's no togetherness in the playing. It becomes kind of a sloppy, free sound, which even in those days I was opposed to, because if you're having arrangements written for 17 men, I think at least 16 of them should play together. But when you have a guy in front who doesn't care what the band sounds like, you tend to take advantage of that attitude, and then before you know it, everything starts to fall apart. And even then, I was sensitive to that and didn't dig it.
Well, Artie was somewhat different in his concept than Bunny, wasn't he?
Artie was a very strict disciplinarian, to the point where he was as bad as a disciplinarian as Bunny was, as a free-for-all kind of man. We never could reach a kind of a happy, middle-of-the-road attitude with leaders. Most of the people that I've worked for have been very, very difficult. Artie Shaw was a difficult man, and his personality and my personality clashed considerably, and we had many rounds at it. But Artie was kind of a strange man insofar as that he was a perfectionist in his playing, but he wasn't a perfectionist as far as his band was concerned. There again, we had discipline without intelligence. It was carried like a sergeant who comes down from the Mississippi mud and tries to tell the city boy how to behave in the city. It's you have to understand that when you have 16 people up there, discipline is one thing, and the knowledge of how to discipline these people and get them to feel that we're all together in it. This is the thing that comes with understanding of the people that work for you, and Artie never took the time to understand the different temperaments of the people in his band.
Artie's band was a better band than Bunny's, wasn't it?
It was a much better band, but Artie's band also became mechanical after a while because he wanted things so strict in his playing, in the procedure of the band, that sometimes he would ask the various soloists if they played a solo that he particularly liked. He wanted that same solo in every night at the same chart. He wanted the same thing played, which gave no chance for the individual to have a chance to improvise and to be creative. And this is wrong in a jazz band. You have to improvise and you have to become creative in order to be spontaneous.
Well, we're talking about Artie's band. Just in a couple of months, a new album has come out featuring things that Artie did back in 38 and 39. And Artie doesn't even play on the album.
He conducts. He conducts the thing. I forget. I don't even know who's playing clarinet.
Walt Levinsky, is that it? Levinsky?
Walt Levinsky?
Yeah.
It's possible. He's on The Tonight Show. He plays clarinet on The Tonight Show. It's possible that it's Walt.
What do you think about those recreations, Bud?
I don't think that there's a reason for it. You can't. It's great if 1939 ever comes back. We'll be ahead of the game. But in 1969, I don't think that we're not introducing anything new to the young people. What we're introducing is something old to the young people, and I don't think anybody is that concerned with what happened 30 years ago. I know I'm not. As a musician, I can't see anything beneficial to it. All I do is hear things that I've heard 1,000 times before, so there can be no thrill in it for me. There can be no excitement in it for me because it's something that's old. you know, it's been done.
Well, from Artie Shaw, you went on to what Frank Sinatra has called the General Motors of the band business, Tommy Dorsey's outfit. Mm-hmm. He was totally different from Bunny and certainly Artie, wasn't he?
He was more like Artie than anyone else, but Tommy Dorsey was strictly Tommy Dorsey. Tommy Dorsey was a great, great trombone player, probably the greatest melodic trombone player that ever lived. But as a man, he left a lot to be desired. And that goes for his temperament, his treatment of people, his treatment of musicians, his treatment of an audience. He was a very cold man, many personalities. I think if anyone could be described as a schizoid, I think it would be Tommy Dorsey, because when he was drunk, he was friendly and warm, and when he was sober, he didn't recognize you. He was a complete split personality, and not the kind of a guy that I would consider a friend.
Was that the best of the three bands that you played with back in, you know, the early 40s and the late 30s?
I would think that particular, well, of course, there were so many of the Tommy Dorsey bands. I think the best band that Tommy had was about 1941 and 42, when he had Ziggy Ellman, and Nelson Riddle was playing trombone in the band at the time, and Ray Conniff was playing trombone in the band at that time, and Sinatra was singing, Connie Haynes was singing with the band, the Pied Pipers, Joe Bushkin played piano, Buddy DeFranco. I think that would probably be the best of the big bands for that era.
Well, you came back with the Dorseys when the Dorsey brothers formed their band back in, what, 53, I think?
Well, I came back with the Dorsey, with Tommy Dorsey, when I got out of the service in 1945, and I stayed with that band. I got out of the service in 1945, and I rejoined the band. I don't know why, except that he offered me so much money to come back with the band, it was hard to turn down. I stayed with the band about 9 months. Then in 1946, the end of 1946, I organized my first big band with the help of Sinatra, who gave me a lot of money to put into the band. But that seemed to have been the wrong move, because in 1947, 48, of course, you realize that was the time when big bands were just starting to go downhill. And I was fighting to keep the big band thing alive, but it was a losing battle. The beginning of 1949, I finally disbanded and started organizing small groups. I went with Harry James for a while, and did several tours with Jazz at the Philharmonic. I was kind of floundering for a long time there. I wanted to get out of the music business entirely because of what was happening. And I did a lot of recording with various jazz groups. I did a lot of things with Basie and a lot of things with Diz and Charlie Parker and Lester Young and Art Tatum, Oscar Peterson, Lionel Hampton, just about everybody that I had any respect for in jazz. And I couldn't find out just exactly where I wanted to go. It was one of those things where I've always been a big band drummer, and always had, my first love was always a big band, and it kind of upset me to think that this was a part of my life that was disappearing and perhaps would never come back.
But did it, was it a difficult thing to adjust your, or wasn't an adjustment, your method of playing from swing era bands to the modern bop sounds of the late 40s? Did you notice a change in your own technique?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you see, all these things, all these words that you use, bop and modern and progressive, it's all music, and it's an application of how you play it which makes it modern or old-fashioned. The music itself is the same, the notes are the same. It's a matter of interpretation and concept. And I find that, or I find it now, and I found it then, that the musicians that I work with would bring out in me the way of playing that I thought was correct for what was being played. It had nothing to do with the styles, it just had a matter of, the only thing that mattered was, could you play and make these other people sound as good as they could sound? And that's the function of a drummer, is to make the people that you're playing with get more out of their instrument than they normally would. That's the difference between a good drummer and a drummer, is to get the most out of the other musicians. You have to inspire them, and you have to create a fire under them that perhaps makes them get into the horn, into the instrument, so that they can become more creative.
How do you remember that 46 band? Was it a good band? Were you pleased with it?
The band I had in 46 was a hell of a band. It was strong, very intense. I probably had some of the best of the new musicians. Al Cohn worked for me. Zoot Sims worked for me. Tiny Khan worked for me. Terry Gibbs worked for me. Who else? Jimmy Giuffre worked for me. I think I had some of the best of the to-be young musicians. I think I had discovered them, and they went on to
better things. All end up in Woody's band?
Most of them did, as a matter of fact. I remember when I was at the Palladium in Hollywood in 1947, Terry Gibbs was on my band at the time, and Woody had offered him $25 more than I was paying him, and it wasn't a question of the $25. If Terry had come up to me and asked for a raise, it would have been one thing, but he came up, the same as a guy would hold you up, he came up and he said, "Listen, Woody Herman just offered me $25 more than I'm getting." I said, "Take it." If he had said to me, "I need a $25 raise," there was a better chance of him getting it. But he was making it sound as if I don't get it, I'm leaving. And before he got around to saying that that's the way it was, I simply fired him. But a lot of the guys that worked for me later went to Woody's band.
Well, after you spent some time with your own band, a little bit later on you did join the Jazz at the Phil tours. What was your impression of Norman Granz's 10 shows?
Well, that's hard to say. There were some nights where the music was electrifying. There were some nights where it was so dull that it couldn't be heard at all. And that was strictly because of his presentation. It was a money-making scheme. I can't put Granz down for it because he had a thought, and while he used the greatest names in jazz to promote his own thing, some nights musically it was as thrilling a thing as you'll ever want to hear. There were other nights, like I say, that were just completely dull nights because of traveling conditions, because of halls that we played, because of certain temperaments within the various groups that he had organized. That it made it kind of an unhappy thing for a while. Some nights very happy, other nights very unhappy.
It seemed to me that would be the case because some of the greatest jazz musicians of our time were, in my opinion, and I think now in yours, rather exploited.
Oh, of course. The whole idea of jazz at the Philharmonic was exploitation. While Norman paid a lot of money to the various musicians, he never really paid them what they justly deserved. You know, he was making all kinds of money off the names of all these people. When you have a concert that consists of all the people that I've mentioned, plus Ella Fitzgerald, plus Harry Edison, plus Krupa on several tours, Louis Belson on several tours, Max Roach on several tours, he always had something going. It was more like a circus rather than a jazz concert. And of course, audience reaction was always so ridiculous that it didn't make any difference what anybody was playing, because the minute Flip Phillips would get up and honk in his ridiculous style, the kids would start screaming, and then for the next 15 or 20 minutes, wouldn't make any difference whether you played or not, because you couldn't be heard. But that's one of the things that Norman liked, because it built up an excitement, which was, I think, only you can only compare it to the excitement that the Beatles caused when they first started. It was that kind of screaming and yelling. Not really listening, but just kind of let you know they're there.
Well, after you played with several big bands in the 50s, you formed your own small group. And what musical idea did you have in mind when you formed the instrumentation of that little sextet?
I gather you're speaking of the sextet with Mike Maneri on vibraphones and Sam
That's right.
on flute. I thought it might be a combination of the Goodman technique of the Goodman days of the quartet with a little more of the sound of 56 by adding a jazz flute, jazz trumpet, and a jazz trombone. And to take the standard songs rather than have original things written, which of course we did later on anyhow. But I think that basically it was try to do what big bands had done in the past, taking the great melodies written by so many of the great songwriters of the past and make them into jazz charts. And instead of dancing to them, just have it become a concert. And it was very successful. The thought was very successful because later on, a lot of groups, a lot of the TV commercial things now are using practically the same instrumentation, vibes and flute, electric guitar, trumpet. But that never really did satisfy me because my career hangs on big bands. It's that's where I'm at. There's nothing that will ever replace the sound of four trumpets and four bones and five saxes all playing together and all having the same kind of general excitement, each cat in the band becoming one. That's the important thing in a big band, is that when everybody's playing at one time and getting that the fire across to an audience, this is something that can never be duplicated in a small group. The impact, the intensity of a big band, the sound of a big band, there's nothing sweeter in life. That's really where it's at.
Which brings us to the early days, the formation of your wonderful, your great big band right now. When did you first get the concept of having your own band, and what musical criteria did you have in mind for it?
I didn't have anything in mind for the band that I have today. The only thing that spurred me on to getting a big band was the fact that it was needed. Nothing new had been injected into the band business in the past 10 or 12 years. Everybody had been relying on their past successes, playing the same arrangements that they had been known to play for the past 10 or 15 years, with nothing new in music. And the fact that what was happening new in music, as far as the young people were concerned, was that nothing new was really happening. I mean, the electronics, the electric guitar, the amplification, that has always been around. The only thing that changed was the volume. It's just that much louder now. But the formation of my band came to me because I was so bored in the band I was working with at the time. And I felt that I wasn't creating anything new as far as my own playing was concerned, because I was kind of swallowed up in the band that I was working with. And he was content to rely on his success of 1940 and 50, and that wasn't good enough for me. And I figured that the only way that I can get out of this and try to inject some new blood is to organize a young band and some young arrangers and sit down with them and discuss where we can go and what we can do as far as reaching a complete audience, rather than either a young audience or an old audience. To reach a complete audience, let everybody enjoy what we have to say. And in the first 5 or 6 months of the organization of my band, it was a very trying time because the band was very unsuccessful. We were in Las Vegas at the Sands Hotel, and it looked like the band was really going to fold. But we had been booked into a little joint in Los Angeles called the Shea, and that was in the end of 1966, and it was such a magnificent thing. The opening night was one of those world premiere kind of nights where you look up and you see just about every star that ever meant anything in the music business or the entertainment world. And they kind of grasped this band. The reaction was so fantastic that every night we were in this club for 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, and every night was like opening night. And just about every writer, every newspaper columnist, every reviewer, all of a sudden realized that what we had tried to put together had finally come together. And that's been 2 years now. The band hasn't stopped since the very time we opened in Los Angeles. The band hasn't stopped. It's just been one continuous success after another. It's really been thrilling.
Who do you credit for its success? I mean, we credit you, but who do you credit?
Me.
Bless you.
Well, I mean, you're asking me a serious question, I imagine, and I have to answer it honestly. I think it's through my own, whatever you want to call it, my own ego, my own pride, my own money, and my own concept of where I wanted to go, what I wanted to do. Then secondly, I credit the musicians that work for me, because they're playing what I put in front of them, and they're playing it the way I want it played. They have a certain amount of freedom, but we were talking about discipline before. I'm a very strict disciplinarian as far as my band is concerned, and I feel that this is the only way that we can stay together. There has to be a leader, and there has to be a sideman. And I don't use that as a cast now. I don't say that I'm the leader, and therefore we have nothing in common. We have everything in common, off the stand. On the stand, I'm the leader. and they better know it, and they do know it. That way there's respect, there's admiration for them, for me, and there's an understanding that I don't tolerate foolishness. Off the stand, we party, we travel, we talk, and we do everything else that everybody else would do. Thirdly, I have to talk about the people that write for me, my arrangers. Bill Holman, Shorty Rogers, Don Pystrip. These people have written most of the, Bill Reddy, who has written most of the suites, the heavy things, West Side Story and Channel One and things like that. But when I have an idea for a chart, I never just call an arranger. I don't call Holman and say, write so-and-so. I wait till I get back to California and we sit down and we discuss it and find out the best interpretation of whatever particular thing I want to play. And that way we have an understanding of where we're going to go rather than calling an arranger and saying, I'd like you to write a chart on Norwegian Wood. It may not be what I want, but if we talk about it in front, then we know exactly where we're going. And this is, I think this formulates the success of the band, the fact that it's my creation, they're my ideas, they're his arrangements, and they're my players. So I think that all together, the whole thing is it's like the Jets, you know. Namath is the quarterback, he calls the plays, they're out there to catch his pass, and that's the way it is with the band.
Where did you find your players, mostly?
Oh, they're from all over. Some from Chicago, a couple from New York, a couple out of Berklee School in Boston. Where else? I think New York, California, Boston, and Chicago. I think that's where most of the kids are from.
You have much of a turnover, Bud?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have a turnover because of the Army situation. They're all very young, and they get called up quite regularly. And it's a very unhappy thing for me because just as the band is starting to sound together, a big hole is left open because some kid is drafted. But right now, the band is together. My bass player, the bass player I'm using here, is a substitute because my regular bass player was called to Los Angeles for his physical. And luckily, he was turned down, and he'll be back with the band when we open in Reno Thursday. But I don't think I'll have much more of a problem because most of them have either been in the Army or they have been rejected, so that's good for me.
Do you think your band is being accepted by the younger crowd? I mean, the 15 to 20-year-olds?
I like to think that the band is accepted by everybody. We don't play for particularly the 15-year-old any more than we play for the college man or the graduate or the executive. My band is geared for listening by everybody. It's made for everybody. I'll give you a perfect example. The band has been playing a great deal lately to these Electric Factory type places. We played the Electric Factory in Philadelphia. We played the Kinetic Palace in Chicago last weekend. We played the Fillmore East in New York City, second time. And I find that there's just as much acceptance as far as that group you referred to as the 15-year-old group. I think that they're as aware as they were in 1935 when they were 16 and 17 years old and they grasped onto Benny Goodman. I think that they look up at us and they see that we're not trying to be super hip, we're not trying to be super square, we're not trying to be super anything, but we're trying to play good music. And I think they sense a quality of sincerity about our playing. We don't do anything to gimmick it up. We play straight-ahead music. And I think that if you're honest with the people, whether they're 10 years old or 50 years old, if you're honest, you'll be accepted. If you're trying to put them on or put them down, then, of course, you have a battle on your hands. We don't do any of that.
You get tips from your daughter on that stuff, do you?
I don't get tips on it, but she's very aware of what we're doing, and she has her own ideas about certain things that we record. And my daughter is a very hip little kid. She's 14 years old and very aware about music. And, of course, her musical tastes have changed a half a dozen times in the past 5 or 6 years. And I use her as a barometer. Some of the things that we play, I watch her reaction, and she digs certain things more than others. But that's her bag. I may not agree with her, but in my house, there's a certain amount of freedom. Not terribly much, but a certain amount.
Buddy, you've had many careers, so to speak. One, of course, world famous. Your fabulous technique on the drums, but you do have some other aspects of Buddy Rich that we particularly like. One of them is the fact that you're a pretty darn good singer. Where did you get interested in this aspect of it?
Yeah, I've always enjoyed singing. It's a lot different than actually playing drums. And I think only because in singing, you can become a little more emotional involvement lyric-wise, and you have a chance to do something that's a little more musical. Because drumming, unless you're completely associated with the art of drumming, the technique of drumming, to the lay ear, it's a guy sitting up there banging on a bunch of heads. In singing, you can say a lot of things that you ordinarily would not say playing drums, and your moods can vary greatly. Singing ballads, love songs, or singing jazz, your interpretation is vocal rather than physical, like it is on a drum. And I thought I'd take a crack at it because I've always had great admiration for great singers. Of course, my favorite singer has always been Sinatra. But I have great respect for Tony Bennett, Jack Jones, El Torme, Lou Rawls. There's maybe 10 or 12 of the male singers that I really dig. And they all seem to have something to say when they sing. And this is a beautiful thing. It shows a little more of the inside of the individual, something that you can't really show on a drum. I think when guys play horns, they are showing what they're made of inside. Bobby Hackett, for instance, he decided to sing, I'm sure would probably be one of the most beautiful singers that ever lived because of his interpretation on the horn. But when you play drums, you really can't get that involved with the personal thing of how you feel. And I think singing is one way of bringing it out.
How did you get started in it professionally? Did you do some singing in clubs?
No, I recorded some vocal albums, and I did take a shot at a nightclub appearance in New York at the Living Room back about 10 years ago. Met with very little success, I might add, because when you're involved with one particular thing like I am, drums, your audiences, when they come in to see you, even though it's a new career, you're starting singing as a new career, they come in, and if you don't play the drums, they feel as though they haven't gotten their money's worth, you know. And with my temperament, I wasn't too happy about that. They'd come in and say, okay, when are you going to play? I never did play while I was doing the singing thing. I had a quartet with me, John Bunch on piano, who now plays piano for Tony Bennett, and a great bass player, a great guitar player, and a very fine little drummer. But it was always a question of, when are you going to play drums? So I figured if they want drums that bad, then I just won't sing. I'll just get up and play drums with the band. So my singing career lasted about 8 months. But I had fun doing it.
Who are some of your favorite composers?
Oh, just about all of them. I think everybody that's ever written in the past 20 years has always had something. It's Rodgers and Hart, Johnny Mercer, Jimmy Van Heusen, Lerner and Lowe. I guess I'm no different than any of the other people that like a good lyric and a good melody. I think that these people have done more for the music business than anybody else, any of the new writers. And when I say the new writers, I'm speaking of people like Jim Webb, who, you know, all of a sudden took the world by storm because of Up, Up, and Away. But Up, Up, and Away is one tune. That's, you don't make a career out of one tune. I don't think by the time I get to Phoenix is another Night and Day or Stardust. I don't think it ever will be. So we have a tendency to take greatness very lightly, and just somebody does something, takes a shot at something and comes up with it. That doesn't make you great. It makes you great only after you've created constantly for 20 or 30 years. Then you can be titled great, but not on one shot.
That's so true. You also are a pretty good hoofer. So when did you start on that?
Well, I never really started on that. That was the thing that came about because of my association with people in show business, even later on when I became a musician. what other bands I was with, we always, when we did theaters, stage shows, we always had a dance act on the bill with us. It was either the Condos Brothers or Baby Lawrence or any one of a half a dozen great tap dancers. And I have very quick learning power, and dancing along with these people, you just automatically pick things up. And that's how my dancing got started. I never really took dancing lessons. It's just that it's like when you hang out with comics, you hear so many jokes from so many different comics that all of a sudden you find yourself telling stories and you're funny, you know? But you're not really a comic. All you're doing is repeating things that you've heard from people who make a living at being funny. That's what it's all about.
Well, but if you don't mind my saying so, I think you're one of the best in the business.
Well, I don't know if I'm one of the best in the business, but you see, the difference between being a comic and being able to go out and just talk, the comics have people writing things for them to say so that they're funny, and the things I say are the things I intend to say. They're not written for me. When I get on the floor and something is bothering me, I talk about it. If an audience bugs me, I let them know they bug me. If I feel good, I feel good. If I feel bad, I feel bad. I don't pull any punches, and I don't try to be a different personality in my hotel room than I am on the dance floor or the ballroom. I'm one man 24 hours a day. I'm not a lot of different people. I'm who I am and what I am, and I know what I am, and I live my life that way.
Don't you think that this aspect of a leader helps a band tremendously? I mean, you and I both can think back on some leaders that were just dollsville out on the stage, and I think this reflected in their band, yet some of them were very electric.
Of course. I think Stan Kenton is a very electric guy up on a bandstand. I think that he's very aware, very sophisticated, and speaks very well. And then you have people like Guy Lombardo. You know, his personality is about as thrilling as his music. So where do you want to go from there? You know, that always has been a part of the music business. A lot of guys are great musicians, but they put the horn down and they're stuck for an answer for hello. But I think that's all changing too. I think with the new awareness today, I think that a lot of guys are finding that I think that audiences are finding out that musicians are not idiots, they're not all dull. I think that they realize now that musicians can have a normal home life, a family life, and can also have outside interests, golf, automobiles, money, whatever.
What are some of your outside interests, by the way?
All the things I just mentioned. Golf, money, and sports cars. And I have all three, and I'm very happy about that. And I have a great family. My daughter's a marvelous little girl. And I've just gotten back together with my wife after 15 years, and I'm happy about that. So the things are going along very well at home now. For a while there was some talk about a divorce, and that only came about because of my being on the road so much and being away from home. While I would like my family to travel with me, it's difficult because I have a young daughter who goes to school, and my wife didn't want to leave her at home with a maid and people at home. And I wasn't about to give up this thing that I'm doing now because it's too important to me. And then I think about 3 or 4 months ago, my wife realized, when she was going through the plans for divorce, I think she realized that divorce wasn't the answer either. I think that she now wants to be a part of what I'm doing, and I'm happy about that. As a matter of fact, I'm going to see her tomorrow. And she'll be traveling with me now that Kathy's getting to be a young lady. She can stay home with a maid and come to see me on weekends. And of course, in the summertime, she goes all over the country with me when she's out of school. So I think that we'll have a better relationship all around this year.
Do you think that the life of a traveling musician has improved somewhat over the last 20 years, Bud?
Oh, there's no comparison. A traveling musician today lives the life of a very wealthy man. Years ago, traveling in a bus was a very unhip experience. It was a very big drag, you know, long trips, 500-600 miles a day, bad food, bad hotels, you weren't making any money, and living conditions were terrible. Today you drive, you ride in the best buses, and actually when we travel by jet plane. We very seldom take a bus, except where the cities are so close together that it wouldn't be wouldn't make any sense to travel by plane. But mostly, we travel by jet. As a matter of fact, when we leave your city tonight, we'll take a bus back to Chicago and hop on a TWA jet tomorrow morning and jet back to Los Angeles. And in the old days, there was no such thing as a jet back to Los Angeles. If you had to go back to Los Angeles, you sat in a bus for 5 days, and you had 5 days off. So that things have really improved vastly. It's a completely different world today.
What's your favorite aspect of the music business? Do you like recordings, television, clubs? What's your favorite?
I don't have a favorite. I think if it's going good in television, it's great. If it's going good for an in-person performance, it's great. If your records are selling, it's great. I think it's all bad and it's all a drag if nothing is happening for you. So you can't really sit and be honestly concerned about, well, I don't want to make television because that's a drag, and I don't want to do one-nighters because that's a drag. I think the minute a musician or a band leader feels that this kind of life is a drag, he should get out of it. I think it's vitally important that you make personal appearances, because you're playing in person for the people that are nice enough to buy your albums. And if they work hard and they find that your music is interesting enough that they can want to go out and spend $5 or $6 to buy your albums, I think you owe it to them, and owing in a sense where you should go on the road and play in person so that they can see exactly what they're buying besides hearing it. A lot of band leaders don't feel that way. They feel that it's just good enough to sit in Las Vegas for 26 weeks a year. I have a very fine deal in Las Vegas and in Reno and Lake Tahoe, but I also think that we owe it to the audiences in Chicago and in New York and in the European countries that we play. It's very important, and I enjoy doing it because it gives me a chance to get around the world, too. This is very important to us.
What was your impression of that summer series with Buddy Greco?
I had fun on the show. I didn't take it seriously because that's not my career. I think Buddy and George Carlin took it seriously because they were looking to get into television. I'm not looking to get into television. Television is extracurricular for me. So that I didn't take it seriously, therefore I enjoyed it. I think that they were a little uptight about it because they wanted something better to happen for them when the summer series was over. I didn't care, so therefore I came out on top of the thing. Because it was nice to sit home for 13 weeks and do television, but it's restricting. You don't have the opportunity to play the kind of things you want to play, and it's a constant hassle between you and the producers and the directors because you can't play an arrangement for 8 or 9 minutes because cameras can't hold on you that long. It's a different concept entirely. It's one thing to do a guest shot and demand the thing that you want to do. It's another thing to have your own show and try to demand it and have to meet with all kinds of resistance from people who know absolutely nothing about music or television, for that matter.
Are you happy the way your band was presented?
Well, let's say that I was happy at the time. Of course, I would never do it again under the circumstances and under those conditions. But it was the first time that a jazz band had had a series like that for 13 weeks, and I was willing to accept other thoughts on the matter. I made a lot of concessions that I wouldn't make today.
What about jazz in general? Do you think jazz has been given a fair shake by the Nets?
No, absolutely not. No, there's a whole new world of music and television entertainment. As soon as these maniacs that run television leave television and let young people in there with a different idea, and to stop with as the world turns, and stop with the doctors and the hospitals and an in-person operation. I mean, this is not entertainment, you know. We haven't even begun to branch out in the field. There's so much untapped talent ready for television. But as soon as these maniacs on Madison Avenue become aware of this and not feel that all American audiences have the intelligence level of a three-year-old, that adults are aware of good things, and as soon as they begin to realize that you can present things other than cowboys and Indians on television, we're going to see a whole new kind of entertainment on that box.
Is this necessarily true in Europe?
No. As a matter of fact, nothing like that is happening in Europe. We were in London a couple of months ago. This is my third trip to England. And we inaugurated the first color jazz show, a series of 26 shows for the BBC, which is a non-commercial owned by the British government, right? And we did the first one-hour special in color, and it was one of the wildest shows that they've ever had in television over there. And no restrictions, and no time limit. In other words, it doesn't have to be 56 minutes and 4 minutes for commercials. If it runs an hour and 4 minutes, that's okay, too. If it runs 97 minutes, that's okay, too, whatever it may be. And your directors, your producers, all your technicians are aware of music. They have some kind of background in music and jazz. And the presentation is marvelous. The acoustics are marvelous. The attitude in the studio is marvelous. It's just like it's comparable to a recording session rather than a television show. And it's only because art is treated with a free kind of hand over there, and jazz is artistic in the European countries. It's not looked down as it is looked down on here and played in basements and in cellars and things like that. Art is a jazz form. I mean, jazz is an art form. And for instance, a year ago when we were over there, we played the Royal Festival Hall, which is like, that's the epitome. You can't get any finer than that. That's where the Queen goes and things like that. It would be the same as playing Carnegie Hall, except that Carnegie Hall has now let everybody in the world in. You know, if you're an ice skater, you can play on Carnegie Hall. But at the Royal Festival Hall, it's still a very commanding and a very demanding kind of night. Your audiences are all in black tie and dinner jackets and everything like that. It's a beautiful thing. The same thing applies in Japan. We played, this is our second time in Tokyo, and we played the Kasanengan Hall in Tokyo, and the Royal Hall in Kobe, and in Nagoya City, in Osaka. The attitude, the appreciation, the warmth that the audience gives to you is so beautiful that instead of going out and doing a two-hour concert, you wind up doing maybe 3 hours or 2 hours and a half or whatever, because there's such a love that between the audience and the artist. You don't really think about time. You don't say, well, you know, we got to get off now because we've been up 45 minutes. It's the thing where you want to stay out there because you have a feeling that they want you out there. And as soon as we get hip enough over here to learn how to treat artists who have career, who have gone through half of their lifespan trying to create and be as perfect as they can be, and be respected for that by the audiences, we've got a lot to learn about how to treat artists over here. Not just jazz artists or pop artists, but everybody that has gone into the arts. You know, we don't treat them with the proper. There's a Hall of Fame for baseball players, but there's no Hall of Fame for a jazz musician. That doesn't make too much sense, you know?
What are some of your impressions of the jazz scene in the United States currently today? Where do you think it's going?
I really don't know. I can't give you an answer to that because, like we just talked about, where is jazz today? Birdland's closed. Most of the rooms that were synonymous with jazz, we don't have it anymore. I find that most great jazz musicians are going to Sweden and to Copenhagen and Paris, Germany. You know, they're getting out of America. We ought to be ashamed of ourselves for letting this happen. These are our people who have created greatness over here, and we don't even respect them enough to keep them over here. As far as money is concerned, as far as recognition is concerned, they have to go to another country to be recognized. That's a very sad commentary on our attitude towards jazz.
What about what might be termed the avant-garde musicians? Do you think that they have anything to do with this?
I think they have very little to do with music. I don't think that they're going anyplace. I think that, you know, they're just creating a little world of their own. I don't think that they're really giving anything to a general public, and you have to be concerned with the general public, not just a few people that think they're so hip that everything else is a drag and this particular group is really it. You've got to expand to a general audience, not just to a certain few. And if musicians think that this is where it's at, they're very wrong, you know. We have to play. Well, I prefer to play, and I prefer musicians to play in an area, in an attitude that's understandable for all. I don't like commercial jazz musicians, but I can understand their plight. I can understand why certain musicians will commercialize certain areas of their playing, because they can't afford to be anything else but that kind of commercial acceptance. This is another sad commentary. We won't accept people who have studied 25, 30 years to be great and then have to go out and then do whatever it is they have to do to make money. And yet a guy like O.J. Simpson can ask for $600,000 bonus to go out and throw a dumb football, you know. But I don't hear anybody offering Dizzy Gillespie $600,000 to open up a school for the future of American jazz. It's kind of sick.
Bud, you do clinics occasionally, you've noted, but what do you think the attitude of these kids are that attend these clinics? Do you think it's basically a healthy one?
It depends. It depends on what cities that you do the clinics in. It depends on the store that you may do the clinic at. I like to feel that there's some hope over here, but I don't really believe it. I think there's more hope. I find better drummers in England than I find in this country. Over here, the young drummers, their favorite question is, say, how do you get fast? You know, it's not how do you play or how can I learn to play better. It's how can I learn to be fast like you? And I tell them by the time they're 51, they probably will attain a certain amount of speed. But they're not really interested in that basic quality of how do you keep time? They're looking, they don't want to know about keeping time. How fast can you play? And in foreign countries, Japan, Paris, Copenhagen, you name it, any of the places that we've been, usually the young drummers will come up to me and ask me the basic questions about drumming, and that is, of course, how to keep time, the best way to keep time, how do you coordinate your hands and your feet. They're more concerned with the art of playing rather than the speed of playing. And so we have a problem over here because we're not developing too many good drummers over here.
Well, Buddy, I'm sure there are probably some young jazz musicians, and I would include probably some young drummers listening to us right now. What are some tips for them? Do you have some advice for young kids just getting started on the drums?
No, I don't have any advice. I find that when you give advice, somebody's always taking offense at it, and it's like trying to set yourself up and saying, my advice to you is to do this or do that, and it's liable to be the wrong advice. So the best advice you can give is no advice, and just say that find a good teacher, practice a lot, be sincere about your playing. This is the most important thing. Be sincere about it. And if you want to play good, play good. If you want to not play good, get yourself a job in a rock band.
Buddy, thank you very much.
Okay, nice to talk to you.